Very warm welcome to this side event on environmental corruption held at the occasion of the 9th Conference of State Parties of the UN Convention Against Corruption. It is the COSP's last day, and I think we've had many great side events, as well as in Sharm, of course, important negotiations happening. Even on the last day, the topic we're discussing is very, very important. My name is Greta Fender. I'm the Managing Director of the Basel Institute, and I'll be your moderator this morning. We've got about an hour, 15 minutes for this session. I think there's nobody in the Sharm room after us, so if we go over by a few minutes, I think there's no harm done. But let's try to stick to that time frame. We will start with a question answer kind of discussion. And after that, or even during the discussion already, you're more than welcome, those in the audience, to put your questions to us. Either you can do that, and we encourage it, in person, and you can use the raise the hand function to do so, and then we will invite you to speak at the right moment. Or you can, of course, also put your questions in the chat, which I'll try to monitor as best as I can while also navigating the discussion. We've got some really great panelists with us today. I'm not going to give long introductory remarks. Suffice to say that I think it's been great in the last year in particular to see a change in that when today we speak about environmental corruption and green corruption, we don't any longer get the who, what are you talking about kind of reaction. It is a lot more commonplace now to talk about it. And just yesterday, I was moderating a panel on quite a different topic where the Secretary of State of Norway gave opening remarks, and she spoke during her 5 minutes at least three or four times about the connection of corruption, environmental destruction, and the sustainable development goals. So I think we are finally at a stage where that topic's no longer very strange. And that's a good start. But let's see with our panelists whether maybe we can report a bit more progress, but also where our challenges lie ahead. Very briefly introducing our great panel today, in no particular order. We have Laude Siarif, an old friend of mine. He's the executive director of Chemitran. In English, the name is Partnership for Governance Reform, which is a leading Indonesian NGO. They've been working ever since the transformation of Indonesia after the resignation of former President Suharto on important governance and corruption topics. And of course, Laude has also for many years been a commissioner of the very well-known Corruption Eradication Commission of Indonesia. He was leading it in a particularly turbulent but also successful time. Also with us is Liz Hart. She's currently the chief of party of the Targeting Natural Resource Corruption Program at WWF USA. And I don't think anyone needs to introduce what WWF is. We've all seen the panda stickers when we were children, and we'll always remember WWF as part of our childhood. And thank God, still in our lives. But it's worth knowing about Liz that she's actually not a conservationist. She very much comes from the corruption and governance field, a longstanding expert. And so she's the person that's going to try to connect the dots between corruption and the environment. I was thinking whether it's a wolf in a sheepskin, actually, when a corruption specialist goes and works in an environmental agency. But I think we are beyond that point. Also with us, very pleased to introduce Agnes Nabire, who is the Assistant Commissioner, I hope I get it right, for tax investigations at the Uganda Revenue Authority. And it's great to have you here, Agnes. URA is a new partner of the Basel Institute's Green Corruption Program. And we're really looking forward to working with you, Agnes, and with your agency. And in this context, I should say that URA has a particularly good reputation for being an island of integrity in Uganda. And, you know, you've been there for 20 years, Agnes, so I dare to say probably you played a little role in this. Great to have you. And last but certainly not least is our own Johanny Grossman, who leads the Basel Institute's Green Corruption Program. I should probably say not lead, but he really built it up in the almost 2 years that he's been with us. And we couldn't be luckier to have someone with the amount of experience that Johanny has, having led very, very large corruption and governance programs in many different countries in the last 15 years. So with these introductions, I'm going to start with Liz. Liz has been up all day. It's 11 p.m. where she is, so you're going to be you're in full swing, hopefully still. And let me talk, perhaps ask you to talk in a few minutes, and we're really going to try, you have a few minutes, don't worry, but try to keep these conversations a little bit like a ping pong game. Perhaps on the one hand, your program at WWF is conducting a multi-year research effort to look at the connections between corruption and the environmental degradation. So I'd be very interested to know a bit more about what you've been finding out so far, and also the quintessential question of collaboration between these two communities, conservation and corruption, which are very different, but both mission-driven disciplines. So it'd be very interesting also in particular to hear how that's going, what are the challenges, how do we bring these communities together? So over to you, Liz, for now.
Thanks so much, Greta. And yes, that's a lot to cover in a few minutes, so I'll probably just touch on a few points. But thank you so much for the invitation to participate with this illustrious panel and to share some insights from the project that we've been working on now for the past 3 years at the World Wildlife Fund and with our consortium members and other partners. I'm sure it will come as no surprise to anyone listening to this conversation that corrupt actions and corrupted systems of governance facilitate and even drive a whole host of environmental ills, and that those are adding up to loss of biodiversity globally, dispossession and exclusion of indigenous groups in countries around the world, deforestation and related climate impact, depletion of critical fisheries and global food supplies that are related to those, just to name a few of the impacts that we know can have corruption behind them in many cases. We in the Targeting Natural Resource Corruption Project didn't need to do a lot of research to establish that premise. The reporting and the evidence is widely available from many sources, but I really should credit USAID, our funder for the project, for being on kind of the leading edge of this conversation. As you noted, you know, that it's become a lot more common to talk about these things, but in about early 2018, when they put out the call for proposals for a project to bring learning from the broader anti-corruption field to bear on the challenges of conservation and biodiversity loss, that was still not a really common thing to be talking about. So what we've been working on in the TNRC project is not so much to establish that there are linkages between these two things, but rather to build a more detailed and wide-ranging understanding of the ways that corruption impacts natural resources and conservation objectives, and especially on how practitioners in the natural resource management and conservation space can do their work in ways that are better informed by this understanding. So it's certainly not possible to cover all the findings. So I thought I'd just highlight a couple of them, at least one, I think, which will really speak to your other aspect of the question about conservation and anti-corruption communities working together. But I'll start by highlighting an area of difference that we came to understand fairly quickly as we launched this project, and something that's been an important element of learning as we go forward to address the impact of corruption on conservation objectives. And that's, while it's fairly typical for people in conservation to start their anti-corruption thinking with an enforcement kind of response, and that's very understandable, partly because the illegal wildlife trade and other environmental crimes are, you know, really kind of the most obvious problems when we start to think about corruption's impact on the environment. What our work is really showing is that corruption affects conservation efforts in so many different ways than just, you know, kind of the common, these sort of first ways that we think about environmental crime and the enforcement to respond to it. So one of the lessons really is that we need to broaden our approach to both understanding what corruption is and then how we respond to it, and do this in a much more systemic way. And I'll just give you one example of that in kind of an unusual space for a conversation about environmental crime. But take something like payment for ecosystem services. This is a really important approach in conservation to encouraging people who live in, for instance, forested areas or near important water resources to protect those resources. But one of the things that some of our research is showing is the ways that corruption can get in the way of people actually being paid equitably for their conservation of a natural resource. For instance, if a district committee chair creates a funds distribution plan that privileges certain communities over others, and often then what the result is that people who are meant to be seeing value for their conservation efforts aren't. And so resources tend to be exploited anyway. So a problem of lack of accountability results in more degradation of the environment. And that is not sort of the typical environmental crime that we might be thinking of when we use that term. But what a corruption, a kind of a wide open corruption lens helps us focus on is the larger systems of how natural resources are governed and where the weak points may be. And then we can start to talk about different ways to respond to that, including maybe strengthening mechanisms for oversight of committees or a grievance system to address inequities, even kind of a wholesale rethinking of who needs to be involved in decision-making in some of these cases. So those are sort of preventive approaches to corruption that might not figure in if we're just starting with an assumption that we need to strengthen enforcement. So that's one example. And then just to respond to your other question about how these communities work together, let me give a different example at the other end of the spectrum. And, you know, at the other end of the spectrum, we have the high level corruption that, for instance, grants logging permits to cronies or in return for kickbacks from other companies or countries, or also the ways that actors in the international system close their eyes to where money comes from or actively assist in hiding the illegal and corrupt sources of wealth. And when we start to look at those kinds of problems, this is where one of the challenges of working across these two disciplines kind of appears. Addressing corruption and its impact on environment and conservation outcomes is really an inherently political undertaking. And this requires social and political analysis capacities and different ways of working with communities and with authorities that aren't always the core skill sets of conservation organizations. Likewise, you know, illicit financial flows and corporate transparency aren't necessarily in the lexicon of ecologists or botanists or animal scientists or the people who fund them. And as you say, the great news is that this is changing. WWF, for instance, is hiring more social scientists around the world, and conversations like the one we're having today and that there have been so many of in the past couple of years is really kind of moving the needle, I think, on the way we talk about these things. But we still have a lot to learn from each other. And one of the things that we've really seen in our project is how important it is to make sure that when we get together and start working together on things, we start with really defining our terms, defining what we mean when we're talking about corruption, what the challenges are that we see, how we're really taking on those definitions and those ways of thinking about these issues. Checking with each other before we just kind of march forward, there can be kind of an assumption of what the values are and what's most important. And sometimes we forget to kind of meet each other in the middle on that and make sure that we have that same understanding. So I'll stop there. I know we're at limited time, but I hope that sets a little bit of context for the great contributions that I know are coming.
No, thanks a lot, Liz. I think you set the scene super well. And I think, you know, the first point you made that, you know, we need to take a much bigger lens. While, of course, you know, the immediate reaction is the enforcement, there's a whole system that directly and indirectly impacts environment where corruption interferes in various forms, or bad governance for that matter. And what you said about the political side of conservation and talking about corruption in conservation it resonates hugely with me, because certainly having worked in this field and especially on the enforcement side as well for many years, there's always a lot of pushback. But the amount of pushback that we experience, certainly when you connect the two, is at a different level, I would say, I guess. I'm going to turn to the other side of the planet, really, almost, and turn to Laure in Indonesia. And perhaps, Laure, if you could just kick off by talking a little bit about what the main environmental challenges in Indonesia are today, and where in these areas or how you see corruption undermining the very, very important conservation efforts that are necessary in Indonesia to avoid further destruction and deterioration of the environment.
Yes, very difficult question, actually, Greta, but I think the main challenge is, if I look at the history of Indonesia, it is the marriage between politics and private sectors, also big corporations. But I don't really think this is only the problem of Indonesia, but also actually a problem in many other countries. But I think this is one of the main challenges, because like it or not, the government is actually the one who who have the power to regulate and to enforce all the law. So if there is the link between big corporations with the governments, so conflict of interest, it is always there. So this is actually undermine a lot of conservation program and effort in Indonesia. To give you an example, based on the study of the KPK in 2018 and 2019, before I finished my term at the KPK, we found out that more than 3 million palm oil actually inside still registered as a natural forest. So this is very struck. This is real. And simply because in those, people who actually are benefited or the beneficial owner of those palm oil, it is actually close or related to the government. So, it is quite difficult for the government actually to take radical measures actually to change it or instead, for example, just this year with the enactment of call it Undang-Undang Cipta Kerja on job creations, there is an attempt to legalize those already inside the forest estate. So this is again because of close interaction between the regulators and private sectors. And if you actually look at the current, for example, government, several ministers they are also in Chamber of Commerce, and also they have very big project in mining sectors, in palm oil plantation, and many others. So I think the main challenge is actually, corruption. Because if you have that, it will be very, very difficult actually to look after our environments. And if you actually check it, the corruption perception index of Indonesia, it is actually down 3 points from 2019-2013. It's now only 37, used to be 40. So that's the brief reality, I think the main challenges in Indonesia.
Thank you, Laure. And sadly, I think, as you said, that increased sort of merger almost between the public and the private sector is sadly not only a problem in Indonesia, but something that we observe around the world and becomes perhaps also more accentuated with certain trends of radicalization or democratic decline in parts of the world. So that's a very concerning development. We talked at the beginning about how green corruption has become no longer, oops, what you're talking about notion, but people do have a sense for what we're talking about. And that is an important change in my view. URA has also undergone quite a significant change, Agnes, or so we feel, in terms of its role and way to fight corruption. And it would be really interesting for those who don't know Uganda as well as you do, and I also know only a little bit, if you could give us a brief overview of this journey, how your agency has kind of evolved in this field.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Honored to participate in this engagement. Yes, Uganda Revenue Authority has been in existence for now 30 years, and it has been undergoing quite significant changes in terms of the fight against corruption. For those participants from other countries, Uganda Revenue Authority in its reform agenda to fight corruption in 2005 and 2006, we embarked on a modernization journey. And in that reform and modernization, the effort was to ensure that we do a cleaning up. So URA went through restructuring, where so many staff were retrenched. And all of us became jobless one day, and we had to reapply for our jobs. So the journey about fighting against corruption started then, and it has been progressing. We had to come up with new structural changes, introduction of tax investigation department, introduction of staff compliance, introduction of code of conduct, offense schedules and disciplinary structures, and increased automation of our processes to limit so much of human intervention in our doing business. And that journey has progressed until 2021, when we received a new leader. And of course, with that change of leadership, and a drive towards wiping up issues of corruption, there was a very serious negative perception on URA, despite this journey of trying to clean up. And so the organization undertook an integrity assessment. And that assessment was done in form of a survey, both internal and external stakeholders participated. And the assessment was based on the revised Arusha Declaration under the WCO tools, with adopted TADAT scores. And with that assessment, there was still observation that URA needed to do much more. And therefore, we came up with a comprehensive integrity strategy, which was approved in April this year, using the balanced scorecard framework. And the key things, just to mention quickly, were to do with focus on our processes and systems, robust automation. And that exercise is ongoing, and recently the IT section was escalated to a department, and we recruited a commissioner to show that that is a sign of serious commitment that we must have our systems and processes fully automated. Another key thing that is happening, we are encouraging our staff in everything that we do to have a resolute in promoting integrity and resisting corruption. And from the strategic level, that has been incorporated in our strategic direction. And the core values, one of our core values is in integrity. So on top of integrity, we are marrying it with patriotism. We believe that if every staff had a patriotic heart, they would actually do whatever they do for the benefit of the country and the citizens. And of course, our ability to do our work professionally. So there is a radical emphasis on whatever we do, we must drive integrity and resist corruption. And of course, we've also revamped our learning and development, where one of the areas we are going to focus on in training our staff is integrity. And recently, the leaders underwent a training on integrity. And the emphasis was that we are building ethical leadership. And the emphasis is that we are saying it's no longer do what I say, but do what I do. The leaders must lead by example. The leaders must walk the talk and not just talk. And that is now the emphasis. We are also engaging our clients. And we also noticed that because of limited information to the taxpayers out there, many of them have been taken advantage of. And because of limited knowledge, even what they don't need to be to pay money for or to bribe, and that they can do it at, on their own, we have revamped tax education to encourage voluntary compliance. And added to that, we've also started alternative dispute resolutions, where we've identified tax liabilities, taxpayers, and probably it was coming out as an offense and undergoing prosecution. We've given a window for alternative dispute resolution. Instead of going to court, let's engage that. That will encourage them to willingly and fully disclose probably what they were not disclosing. There's also voluntary disclosure that we are encouraging our taxpayers to do so. So as I wrap up, another exercise that URA is embarking on is lifestyle audits. We need to ascertain what our staff have. Is it commensurate to the period they've worked and equally to the money they've been earning when we look at what is in their possession? So with those few highlights, URA is committed in fighting corruption, and we are not giving up, and we believe that's the way to go. And this is going to spread out to the entire country, because we believe when URA is fully committed to doing its mandate, then all the finances, the revenue that we are looking for should come in and be able to facilitate the government programs. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Agnes. And it's quite fascinating to listen to the sort of the diversity and the comprehensiveness of the measures. And it's interesting because you talked about pretty much, you know, how it needs leadership, how it needs an understanding of the people that what they do, both in their job and through integrity, they do it for the collective good. It's really that collective responsibility, that social responsibility that is often a little bit lost in very corrupt systems where it's very egocentric and very self-serving. And I think breaking through that is important. And of course, the whole issues of you know, avoiding as many loopholes as possible through automation is really, really interesting. And the whole idea of culture and value. So we'll talk more about this and with you in a few minutes, but in a way that leads me very nicely to Yohani. Because a lot of what you described has to do with the attitude of people and how they understand the connections of what they're doing and how it implicates or impacts on the broader context. And Yohani, I can't see you at the moment. Here you are. I'd like to just, if you could give us the gist. You did recently a really interesting poll on environmental corruption, and we're turning here back to Indonesia, which kind of brought forward something that I don't know if we expected it or not, but you tell us more about it.
Thanks, Greta, and thank you everyone for participating in this conversation. Yeah, it was quite an interesting survey we did, because we tried to use public opinion surveys to get a better sense of what people think about environmental corruption. Now, we kept talking today about the fact that this is an emerging field that isn't so widespread. So getting the public's opinion, who isn't really plugged into this sort of still relatively esoteric conversation, was really an interesting process. And for me, at least, it was somewhat eye-opening, I have to admit. And what we found through our survey, basically, where we looked at people's attitudes both to conservation and to corruption in natural resource management, so plantations, including palm oil and rubber, mining, fisheries, what we found was that people care greatly about the environment. So 93% of the public said that they care and they're concerned about the environment. And people are also greatly concerned about corruption. Two-thirds of the public said that corruption had gotten worse recently, with only 11% saying things had gotten better. And of course, as Laude mentioned, there is very high visibility of the closeness between a government and palm oil and mining firms. And so the public understands that there is high degrees of conflicts of interest and corruption taking place there at all levels. At the same time, and this is, I think, where positions in Indonesia and certainly in Switzerland, but Europe more broadly and perhaps the West diverge, is where the Indonesian public makes a sort of accommodation, despite knowing that there are detrimental governance factors, detrimental environmental factors. At the same time, they come out and say, well, we understand that those things aren't good, but they're really important for the economy. And so when you start digging into these sorts of compromises, if you will, you see a lot of accommodations that people make. So, for example, people say that, well, palm oil isn't great, but it doesn't really hurt the environment, and people are trying to balance things. For example, two-thirds say that palm oil doesn't harm the environment, which I'm sure is a very different attitude to the one we would see in Europe, or at least based on the polls that I've seen. And so this sort of accommodation, this compromise, or if you want, paradox in a way, because people understand full well the challenges that are coming across, including in the fishery sector, where people say, for example, that fish stock has been declining continuously. They understand that this is, or they believe that this is sort of something that we have to live with, because otherwise we can't have jobs, or we don't have enough jobs. And so that's really challenging, because if we look at sort of Western attitudes to conservation and campaigns that are being pushed, I think it will be difficult to see a similar degree of reciprocity among the larger public in Indonesia, certainly, because of this accommodation that's being made, this compromise that's being made. And so if we don't have a groundswell of opposition to these environmentally destructive practices, plus we have very strong anti-foreigner sentiment in regards to natural resource extraction and management, which came across again and again in the survey, we really have a big bridge, a big gap to bridge here. And I'm glad that Laude and his colleagues are really working from the grassroots to build a better understanding about the challenges that are involved and the trade-offs that these compromises bring along with them.
Thanks a lot. I'm still mulling over these results ever since I've seen them for the first time, and how to bridge that huge gap, and also the challenge between the short-term interests of people, yes, having jobs, having money to put food on the table, and the longer-term obvious conclusion: if you have a job but no planet to live on, well, you know, it's not exactly good either. But it's sort of between a rock and a hard place, and finding where we can come in there is going to be really, really continuing to challenge us. Talking about sort of collaboration again and how to connect these points, Liz, you've also spoken about this, but I want to bring in Agnes again on that topic of collaboration, because the URA is of course not a conservation agency. It's also not, strictly speaking, an anti-corruption agency. It's an agency that aims to work with integrity, but you're kind of the odd one out in this group, if I can say that. You administer customs and tax services, but I do believe that your service obviously plays a crucial role in curbing environmental corruption. But it would be interesting if you could explain why what I'm saying may be true, and maybe describe some of the partnerships that you've engaged to play that role in environmental corruption.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Indeed, URA, our mandate is far from environmental crime, but in one of our roles, especially the customs administration, the customs roles, we are supposed to protect our environment, protect the flora and fauna. So indirectly, we actually do participate in that fight. So how do we collaborate? Following the institution of the Horn of Africa Wildlife Law Enforcement Network in November 2017, under the IGAD, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, Uganda, through the head of state, he gave a directive that all the law enforcement agencies should come together. And because of that directive, there was a formation of a National Wildlife Crime Coordination Task Force, where Uganda Revenue Authority is a participant. Now, in our role, because of the way we control the borders and whatever is declared or the transits that go through our country, we find ourselves being actually key in the value chain. So among the agencies or the law enforcement agencies, we have the Ministry of Tourism, we have the CITES Management Authority, that is the Wildlife and Antiquities, we have the Uganda Wildlife Authority, we have the Uganda People's Defense Force, we have the Uganda Police, we have the Financial Intelligence, because there are a lot of monies that move illegally. And then we have the internal security organization and then the external security organization. So the coming up of this task force was basically to put all our responsibilities together to see that we fight this crime. Now, in 2016, thereabout to date, there was an establishment of the Joint Port Control Unit in Kampala and in Entebbe, as I speak now, where we have a multi-agency kind of approach or a team composing of Uganda Revenue Authority, Police, and Uganda Wildlife Authority. And they are deployed to jointly screen containerized cargo for illicit trade. And this is under the WCO UNODC Container Control Program, and we have had a number of seizures. And one of the seizures that took a stage that almost became a global kind of reference was an interception of over three tons of ivory. And because these containers go through URA customs control centers, we were able to actually intercept that ivory. And as I speak, the case was taken up by both Uganda Revenue Authority and the Wildlife Authority. And we did a joint prosecution of that case. And of course, the case is still going on under appeal in the courts of law. We've also jointly worked with the Chemical Safety and Security Project under the Ministry of Labor, Gender and Social Development, where again URA is one of the participants on the steering committee. Personally, I've been the representative on the steering committee for URA and providing technical support, because these chemicals still go through our hands. The project is focused on regularizing the flow of chemicals, biological, radiological, nuclear and explosives into Uganda to minimize the threats and the risks that it poses. So we find ourselves still participating indirectly in controlling threats to our environment or environmental crime. Under the Tax Investigation Department, last year, we came up with what we have termed Interagency Task Force to deal with illicit financial flows. And there is no way you can talk about environmental crime without tackling the issue of illicit financial flows. And right now, we've designed a framework how we are going to work to tackle this pain. So we've established so many MOUs with the Uganda Wildlife Authority, with the Financial Intelligence Authority, and many other agencies, the police, the UPDF, because we want to ensure that we jointly adopt the intergovernmental approach, the holistic approach, that all the law enforcement agencies and all other government administrations come together so that we liberate our economy from any kind of illicit functions that affect the environment and indirectly affect the revenue and the benefits that probably would have gotten as a country. Thank you very much.
Goodness, Agnes, again, once again, you've given us a lot to think about. And I think both your answers, the first one and this one, really show the complexity and the necessity to involve so many aspects, so many actors. And I have to say, sometimes I feel quite happy in my little office, only having to think about corruption in my little space. That task sounds incredible. And that does bring me maybe over back to Liz. Because if we're faced with all these options where we can intervene and where we can try to make a difference and try to change, sometimes, you know, in light of limited resources and competing priorities, we need to make choices. So I'd be very interested to see, Liz, if in your research you've come up with some areas that are maybe holding back the achievements more of the SDGs, more some areas where we need to focus on in either anti-corruption or anti-corruption conservation interventions. Where would you point us? What should we prioritize?
Oh, that's a very difficult question, and given that I'm the one advocating a broader understanding of corruption and the ways that it affects what we are trying to achieve regarding the environment, I'm not sure I'm the right person to say there's a priority. But I guess there's a couple of things. I think I'm really I'm very moved by what Laura has also highlighted, which is the very difficult challenge of the relationships between high-level political actors, even high-level criminal actors, and corporations, and the whole mix of what we would call kind of grand corruption. And we tend often to go to the lowest end because it's where we can manage the response a little bit more effectively. But it's one of the reasons that the awareness of the very high levels at which these dynamics are really driven, or from which they're really driven, I think is one of the reasons why I'm so pleased to start seeing the environmental conversation and the conversation about illicit financial flows and corporate transparency and beneficial ownership transparency and those kinds of aspects. So I wouldn't say it's the only thing by any means, and not even necessarily the thing we should prioritize above all others, but I'm very encouraged by the fact that we're starting to look at the environmental impact of the way that very powerful, very wealthy actors are driving a lot of what's going on. And it's a good antidote, I think, to the assumption that the problem is on the ground all the time. You know, the individual poacher, the individual shipment of illegal goods, that kind of thing. So on the other hand, I honestly think that until we also have, societies that protect civic space and the voice for the unrepresented, we're also really not going to be able to achieve what we need to. So it's obviously multi-pronged, and I wanted to give you a priority, but I have to give an alternative as well. And there are so many in between. But that is, I think, a couple of the dynamics that we're seeing being very important.
Can I just have a quick follow-up here, Liz, because maybe you finally have the answer to the question that I just can't answer. Because yes, it is exactly at the very top and the alternative as well. But how do we get these leaders to move from making great speeches to being held just a tiny bit more accountable for the sincerity of their commitments? How do we get them to change a little bit their behavior?
If I had the answer to that question, I'm sure I'd be, leading some big campaigns somewhere. So Greta, I'm not sure if I can really answer that. And especially when we look at the very serious issues of trade-offs that are involved and the multiple pressures that are on leaders as well. So some may be leading with very good intentions, some may be leading with incredibly poor intentions, but we are under a lot of pressure. So, I mean, I guess the one thing I would say is that these kinds of conversations where the environmental community is coming together with the good governance and the anti-corruption community potentially allows us to draw some connections between these things that, help those who are more willing to respond on the environmental front to understand that there's some other pieces of this that have to be in place, and vice versa. Those who are much more concerned about illicit financial flows and terrorist finance and criminal activity and those kinds of things actually getting mobilized because of the threats to our very existence when we start to talk about climate. Maybe there's some reason for hope in that coming together.
I think that's a really good impromptu answer, actually, because I think the keywords for me is the trade-offs that we, of course, have to make, but explaining those better and perhaps then being able to make different choices in these trade-offs with the support of the public, who then understand why you make those trade-offs and so on and so forth, I think is perhaps the direction in which we need to travel. So the conversations that we're having here hopefully will help us move as a broader society in that direction and that understanding. And I'm going to move over to Laure now. And I have a feeling he's going to talk a little bit about those interconnections between corporations and the public sector again. One area which is, of course, hugely threatened by environmental destruction, yet absolutely essential for our lives, merely because it helps us breathe fresh air, are the trees and the forests, which are destroyed at an incredible speed around the world. And you've written a paper on corruption and forestry. And you've looked at this is not just sort of an academic exercise, but you've really digged very deep into cases and investigations in this field. Perhaps you can just give us an example of one of those corruption cases in the forestry sector, or tell us a bit what you wrote in this paper, because I think sometimes an example really helps to demonstrate what we're talking about.
Yes. It is actually a paper actually written based on the real case. It is not something that it is not an academic exercise. It is an academic exercise, but based on the real case. I mean, if you look at all cases prosecuted by the KPK on forestry related or mining related, it is involving from at the lowest, the head of a district, of a mayor level, the governors, member of parliament, ministers. So, I mean, and unfortunately, they bribe those high-ranking officials to get the license. The second, it is actually trying to, they give a bribe to avoid a prosecution from the ministry, from the police, and of course from many other relevant law enforcement agencies here in Indonesia. So unfortunately, I mean, the big corporations, it is kind of like untouched, but because they know how to do it properly. They just use this kind of like a small companies are directly bribed. It is not them. So, but if I can look at carefully, they are part of the supply chains of this big corporation. But sometimes they are not based here in Jakarta, but actually based in other parts. So law enforcement agency, it is always difficult if it is already transnational crime. So I would say, I will always say that big natural resources corruption, it has to be tackled not only nationally, but actually internationally. So I'm really, really hope that actually UNODC and UNCAC, they can come up with like a resolution and communique or whatever in this particular meeting, because this is very real and it is very, very important. So when Agnes actually trying to guard the board of Uganda, I have a special case in Indonesia, for example. The number of vessels actually leaving Indonesian port, it is actually different from the recipients port in other parts of the country, simply because they just manipulate the number of the vessel actually travel the export. So this is actually the real case. And I don't want to be very, very pessimistic, but I think it is also important to highlight that if there is a willingness of the government with the current change of attention, for example, climate change, for example, Indonesia has been hailed as like the superpower of climate change, the superpower of the environment, because we still have some forest left. Meaning the government, they have to use that resources not to cut the trees, but instead actually to take it as another economic opportunity by selling carbon, for example. But this is still a long way to go, but I think we hope we can actually have that. The second, there is a question, I think from her name, I think must be Indonesian, Herdianti Indapuspita. She said that she thinks the enforcement of natural resources corruption is supported by data disclosures, which is, I agree fully with that. Just to give you an example, that during SBY administration and the current president, actually, when I was in the KPK, I almost, pushing them to have this, call it one map project of Indonesia. But until today, we have not successful in creating this one map to be used by the whole stakeholders in Indonesia. Because some government agency, for example, land authority, they do not who owns those what in Indonesia called HGU, hak guna usaha, or utilization right of forest, for example. They don't want to disclose this, and which is very, very important to be disclosed, because that actually the way how to prevent corruption. And also, we can actually have the real data. So if one particular company actually have like a million hectares of concession, that he has to pay tax as much as the concession that he has. But if you actually close this, this will not actually help at all. So that's why I think we have to do it. Technologically, we can do it even easier. And if there is a willingness of the government, but we cannot just rely our hope on the good faith of the government. I'm not in that. So we have to demand the government. I think we have to create actually big demand from the only from Indonesia, but I mean from the international society. They want to accept, for example, this palm oil if the chains of supply actually clean from corruption, for example. I think that's my point, and I really think that we have to do it together, not only on us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I tend to be occasionally a bit pessimistic as well. You didn't help with that, but let's be hopeful. I mean, one point that was made, which is a bit provocative, but I think still worth mentioning occasionally, is that, you know, there was the COP26 not so long ago, and one of the things that was constantly said is, you know, we need, you know, there's an issue with the funding of this, right? But then you look at what happened with COVID. And of course, COVID was an immediately life-threatening situation for many. I'm not blaming governments at all for putting the money at the disposal for all of this relief action. But clearly, there is that possibility for many governments to raise that money very quickly and very swiftly. And so why is it not done for the environment, which is equally life-threatening, but perhaps not tomorrow, but the day after tomorrow? And in a way, that kind of discourse, when you say we need to ask for governments to put that money and the resources at our disposal. And that does nicely lead me back to Agnes, actually, for our second of last discussion point. And then we can open to the audience. Laure, thank you for monitoring the questions. You've already answered one, much appreciated. I encourage the audience also to raise your hand if you want to say something or put more questions in the Q&A. But Agnes, we just talked about the money, which is, you know, QRA's main business, really, raising revenue, state revenue. And it's this kind of vicious circle, right? Because anyway, obviously, it's quite obvious which vicious circle I'm talking about, but it would be interesting if you could talk specifically about not how corruption impedes the collection of state revenue, but how environmental corruption specifically reduces state revenue and makes it so difficult ultimately then to have the resources to invest in conservation.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Yes, looking at the area or the topic of discussion regarding the environmental crime, I'll just highlight two or three areas where Uganda Revenue Authority is actually losing revenue, and yet there is negative impact through these activities in our environment. We are having a challenge of illegal fishing. It has been a rampant challenge where the head of state took interest to see that there is control on the fishing sites and deployment of the Uganda, the UPDF and the Uganda Defense Force, Uganda People's Defense Force, and the Uganda Police, and together with Uganda Revenue Authority staff in customs. Now, besides just the risk of food shortage and straining the export industry, especially export of fish, there has been a challenge of having all the fishmongers, the fishermen, registered to pay taxes, because we've identified it as a very, very lucrative business where there's a lot of income, but we are yet to tap into that revenue. And like my colleague from Indonesia highlighted, there's been a lot of corruption, even in the processes of trying to formalize that business. There is a lot of illegality in it. The kind of fish nets that is being used, how the unqualified fish nets end up there, it leaves a lot to be desired, because of the element of the people in the process, in the value chain. Corruption has frustrated the process, but we are still in it. to see that we streamline that the illegality actually comes to an end. And whoever is actually doing the fishing should pay their fair share of taxes. When you look at illegal logging, we're also having issues of illegal exploitation or depleting of our forests. We have a lot of trees that have been cut in the name of being cut for exportation. But there are areas where the government has been so strict that trees should not be cut. But we've seen illegal activity still happening. And of course, where there is any illegal kind of business, revenue cannot be picked. And of course, in that area also, we are working together with the forestry authority to see that we have control in that area, that we don't just suffer the depleting of the environment through the cutting down of trees, but equally get the fair share of taxes from whoever is actually participating in that activity. And then finally, we've been having a lot of disposal of hazardous substances in form of expired foods, expired drugs, or expired beverages. And when you look at the impact on the environment, we are seeing it as a risk to our environment because they are destroyed within the environment, and we do not know how the future actually will hold as far as Ugandan environment is concerned. But the key thing here that probably many have taken advantage of to see that certain goods actually come in Uganda, and on their arrival, when we verify them in customs, we discover that actually they are expired. But we've realized that there is need for us to enhance our policies in that area to manage the disposal of those substances. In other jurisdictions, disposals come along with charges, but as far as Uganda is concerned, there are no charges. Instead, the importer or the taxpayer is allowed deductions of the same in form of a loss in their tax filing. And at the end of the day, that's how we are losing revenue. So in a nutshell, there is indeed an impact on revenue collection as a result of the environmental crime that is being, the environmental crime that is happening. And my conclusion would be that corruption has given room for this vice to grow. And that's why when I go back to the point of interagency collaboration, if all government agencies come together, irrespective of where your specialty or where your administration is mandated or focused on, if we come together one way or the other, one creates an impact or have an indirect or direct contribution to help in fighting these illegal activities. So that's what I can say in a nutshell. Environmental crime has got a bearing on affecting the revenue that comes in, and more so where corruption is facilitating its activity. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Agnes. In a way, you're kind of preempting the concluding statement. Thank you very much for that. But it's really powerful, and it's important because it also shows the multiplicity or the multiplier effect in a certain way. When corruption, as you say, gives room to environmental destruction, corruption steals money from the state already, and environmental destruction contributes further to state revenues going down. And this is just a race to the bottom, is perhaps the better expression, the one that I was looking for earlier. And you mentioned waste, which is also a topic that I think we all need to look at much, much more carefully. And I would love to move back to Liz now, but I'm perhaps if we have a few more minutes on that one. But let me turn to Yohani for our final question, and also encourage, anyone in the audience who has a question, this is your chance to ask it in a minute. We do have one question from Elena, and she asked whether we, the speakers, could be so kind to give examples of effective collective action in the field of green corruption and what the results were of those actions. And I'm going to ask you, Honey, perhaps to talk generally speaking about some of the anti-corruption tools that we've been implementing aimed at reducing environmental crimes. And perhaps at the end of that, also add a point about collective action, although in a certain way, what Agnes has been describing is also a form of collective action, of course, so that we already have a semi answer to that, of course. But if other speakers want to comment on that question later on, please do so. But perhaps Yohani first.
Yeah, thank you, Greta. Just briefly, I mean, obviously, the we think we've talked in great detail about the connection between environmental degradation and corruption. And so the interesting element becomes, I think, whether the anti-corruption tools that we've all honed over the last few decades are as applicable here as they are, if I would call it the generic anti-corruption field, or perhaps which tools are more effective in particular areas. And so we've spent quite a lot of time testing these. The biggest one is in particular is on our enforcement side, no surprise, the financial investigation and asset recovery work, where we have a team of five working in three countries, assisting government agencies in that field. And what we found is that there's great potential there. It's really an underutilized tool, despite the fact that it is talked about quite widely. But it also requires a lot more work and effort than we, I think, originally anticipated, because the natural resource management agencies are not really set up to conduct financial investigations. They focus on the environmental goods with good reason, and not so much on the money and following the money. And so it's not just a capacity question. It's also or a technical skill question. It's also a question of institutional setup. So there's quite a lot of work that with great potential to be done here, starting with the very beginning of the investigation. And I was very glad that Liz mentioned prevention, because I agree with her wholeheartedly that that's perhaps something that isn't quite focused enough on yet in the environmental crime and corruption intersection. And so that's an area where, with support of TNRC, we've been doing quite a lot of research on finding ways to develop tools or adapt tools on corruption risk assessments. Of course, some tools are already out there, specifically focused on natural resource management. And now in the second year of the research, focusing on internal controls and how to assess and strengthen those. And then moving on to Yelena Vandasheva's question from Russia. Thank you for that question very much about collective action. So that's actually an area that we're exploring right now, and perhaps a practical spin-off of the more research-focused TNRC program, where the Global Platform for Sustainable Natural Rubber, very important. We talked about plantations and rubber before from our Indonesia poll. There is such a collective action already in existence that has been focused primarily on conservation issues, but there are governance elements in that collective action. And we've been working with the Global Platform and WWF to strengthen the governance criteria, the governance commitments, the anti-corruption commitments that are part of that platform. So I would say that that's a good example where the two topics can be brought together quite effectively.
Thank you. And that is a very concrete example, which I'm sure would serve to look for others to look at in other sectors as well. And we're going to look at how we can replicate similar issues. And of course, we've got the EITI initiative, which in my view is also very much an environmental corruption relevant collective action initiative. I don't know, Liz or Laure or even Agnes as well, if you wanted to come in also on this question or any other concluding remarks. We've got about 4 or 5 minutes left, or we can push it a couple of minutes further. Laure, I can see you unmuted yourself.
Yes, I just want to give a little bit of example of collective action at nationwide. I mean, in domestic Indonesian wise. For example, in 2015, the KPK actually launched called how to save natural resources. Natural resources movement of Indonesia, how to save them. And this is actually led by, it's kind of unusual because it's actually led by the KPK and actually follow with all law enforcement agencies, the police and Attorney General Office, and also the Ministry of Environment, Ministry of Mining and Energy, and they actually signed the pact in front of the president. And in that particular time, for example, strengthening the commitment of relevant agencies to come up with, for example, concluding one map, and also as a seed of the, as the beginning of or the foundation of that particular movement, that after that, the Ministry of Energy and Mineral Resources actually established one map mining Indonesia. And also we have this platform online for all licensing in the Ministry of Forestry, for example. That's some kind of like a good example as kind of like people actually get together. In fact, actually, even the military actually come as a party to this particular program, because some mining company usually backed by military officer, high-ranking military officer. So they have to be in that particular same platform. But again, it is unfortunately, after I think in the last 2 years, this movement is not yet renewed, kind of like try to forget it. Even they, for example, revise the mining law, the good mining law, with the current mining law, which is, and also introducing omnibus law on job creation, which is a lot of emphasis not on environmental protection, but the easiness of investments in natural resources. And fortunately, the Constitutional Court of Indonesia already decided that that particular law is unconstitutional, and they give the government 2 years and the parliament to revise the law. So, yeah, except very sad and dark portrait of Indonesian natural resources, sometimes we can find a light. So, yeah, so keep on dreaming, and we have always to demand to the government. Thank you, Greta.
Very, very true. Liz, I'm just looking at you to see if you wanted to come in to for a last comment.
Sure, just extremely briefly. We recently held a symposium in which both you, Greta, participated in, Johanni, and also Laude, and on this issue of conservation and the impact of corruption. And this was really one where the conservation community came together with some people from the anti-corruption world. And I think the message really that came out of that was, conservation gets it. They get that there is a huge problem with corruption undermining so many of the systems that the environmental community is trying to put in place, whether it's tracking supply chains like the rubber initiative that Johanni was just talking about. And they understand all of the ways that corruption kind of just punches holes in every one of these regimes, including the CITES regime and everything else. But, we do have different kind of specializations and capacities and orientations. And so, you know, my hope really is that, you know, the anti-corruption experts that are gathered around the Young CAC, around the work that's going on there just continues to highlight the global existential threat that this is for us, and that, you know, it puts the anti-corruption agenda much higher as well, because it's now tied so closely to what we as a planet face in terms of our survival. And not only that, but the individual communities that rely on natural resources too. So, you know, I hope that conversations like this in the context of you know, the UNCAC are bringing things the other way. We can, neither one of these communities can achieve this alone. And so, yeah, that's what I'll leave the thought with.
No, but I think this is great, and I appreciate you having also, everyone seems to be doing my job of finding appropriate concluding words. Agnes already had them, Laure as well, with his reference to seeing light and having hope. Although, Laure, I would like to point out that on your background slide, there are not many trees left, although it's very green. But we have to look at that issue yes. here. But listen, it's been really great to have you. I don't think we want to push our luck, because I could see that just a minute ago, attendees started to drop off because there are obviously other really interesting events as well. But I do think that that point should give us hope that you made, Liz, at the end, and also the many examples on the one hand about, you know, coming together, be it at the national level in Uganda, be it at regional level. There is a question, unfortunately, which we won't be able to address, but Laure, maybe you want to think about it, about how to engage collective action in the Asia, in the ASEAN region, but really bringing together these forces in countries, across, within sectors, across sectors, globally, and helping each other to mutually elevate the two critical agendas of today's times, which is climate destruction, climate change, and corruption and illicit financial flows. These are the two challenges of our times, of our generation. They are both existential challenges, more important, I would say, than anything else, because if we don't resolve those two problems, we will have no problems left to solve. So helping each other to elevate these to the top of the agenda, with the hope that we see action and we do what we do, I think, is what Agnes said. So with that, I'd like to thank all our panelists very greatly. I do want to acknowledge the importance of our donors and everyone's donors and funders in this program as well. We wouldn't be here talking about this, helping each other elevate. And that goes for you know USAID, who's so prominently supporting the TNRC project, of course, and all the partners involved. And in our case, you know, funding from the UK government, core funding from Liechtenstein, and many other project partners. And I think that really can't be forgotten. And I'd like to thank them too for allowing us to get together and have this panel actually and talk about these issues. With that, I wish you a wonderful last day at the COSP, and ultimately then also a wonderful weekend. And for those celebrating Christmas, nice festivities, and for everyone, a good jump into the new year. Thank you so much.